Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual. For all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs, Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What a list. We've got terror, torture, crackdown in Iran, issues in Guantanamo. We've got genocide in Sudan, war crimes charges in the Middle East, a hard-nosed China, global poverty and economic pressure all over. It's been a tough season for human rights. Today, we'll get the big picture with Irene Kahn, Secretary General of Amnesty International, and Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times, who has made human rights and their absence his beat. This hour, On Point, the big read on human rights. You can join the conversation. Are we moving forward or back or somewhere new on human rights? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Nick Kristof joins us in a moment. With me right now in the studio is Irene Kahn, Secretary General of Amnesty International, the world's largest human rights organization. She took over the post on September 12, 2001, the first woman, the first Asian, the first Bangladeshi, the first Muslim in the job. She's out with a new book this month, The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights. Irene Kahn, thank you very much for being here.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're just about to wrap up your tenure with the Secretary General of Amnesty International, and what a season this has been. Right after 9/11 until now, everything we've seen during that time. Let me put the question to you. Progress or backsliding? Big picture on human rights on this planet.
Well, the big picture is a mixed one. There has been progress. If you take a longer view than a decade, then certainly we've come a long way since, say, the 40s, since 1948, when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted at the United Nations. Mm-hmm. But when you look right now, what's happening around the world, there are many, many hot spots where human rights are not respected, where people, ordinary people, are suffering.
I mean, at your board meetings at Amnesty International, you must have some kind of chart or some way of measuring. In this long view, I take your point. On the other hand, you know, we've made progress since the Middle Ages. But in this decade, do you see, bottom line progress or really a fallback?
Well, in this decade, we've actually seen a big backlash on human rights coming from the biggest champions of human rights. We've seen, in the name of counterterrorism, actually torture being encouraged, people being detained without any fair trial. So that's certainly been a backlash. In this decade, we've also seen an exposure of some of the worst cases of violence against women, rape being used as a weapon of war in eastern Congo, in Darfur, and other parts of the world. So clearly, there's been a pushback on human rights. At the same time, in this same decade, we've also seen progress against the abolition of death penalty in many parts of the world, new laws being introduced to protect women's rights, countries coming out of authoritarian regimes, for example, in Eastern Europe. So it's been a mixed record, but there's a very long way to go when it comes to protecting the rights of the most vulnerable, the most marginalized people in our society.
All that, and not to mention terrorism itself, which is about as big as a front to human rights as one can imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at Pakistan and what's happening there, it's ordinary people who are suffering at the hands of the Taliban, as well as a result of all the military action that is being taken to attack the Taliban. So people are being caught between a rock and a hard place.
On top of the terror sort of torture spectrum, then comes economic, collapse nearly about a year ago. What is the overall impact of the economic setbacks the whole world has seen on the human rights front?
Well, you know, repression and deprivation go hand in hand because some of the poorest countries in the world are also countries which have the worst human rights record. If you look at Burma, for example, or Sudan or Chad in Africa, these are the places where the poorest people are suffering. And I believe that actually human rights abuses drive and deepen poverty. It pushes people into poverty and then traps them in poverty. So there's a direct relationship between human rights and improving people's lives.
We're going to look at that, at your particular thesis about poverty and human rights. You're the first Asian head of Amnesty International. In this decade, we've also seen the tremendous upsurge of China and the Chinese economy. Bottom line, the impact of China's much greater weight in the world on human rights. At home, they are not big champions of human rights. Abroad, they often don't pay a lot of attention. On the other hand, they make the, would make the argument there's economic development here. As head of Amnesty International, how do you see the impact of China's rise?
Well, it's going to be a new challenge for human rights. China has clearly, through its economic progress, has pulled millions of people out of poverty. But China is also one of the most unequal countries today between rural and urban population, between migrant labor in the cities and non-migrant people. China, I think the inequality index in China is about 30 to 1, when in the United States it's about 16 to 1. So yes, there's been progress, but there's also been inequality. And besides, there have been huge mistakes made in China. Don't forget the Great Famine. Don't forget even now the way in which the Chinese government ignored HIV, the spread of HIV/AIDS. So repressive governance is not the best way to promote economic development.
What about the straight-up issue of dissidents in prison? This is what Amnesty International became famous for. You organized groups around the world who would drown repressive governments in letters pleading for the freedom of dissidents. Do you still do that? Do Amnesty International groups still do that for dissidents in China, or you name it?
Oh, yes, we certainly do. In fact, China is one of the top countries when it comes to prisoners of conscience today that Amnesty has on our books. We certainly do that. And we believe that freedom is absolutely essential for development. So when China suppresses freedoms, China suppresses freedom of expression, it's doing no favor to itself. It's actually making it much more difficult to tackle issues like corruption or mismanagement of government.
Do you keep account of prisoners of conscience? Conscience on this planet? Is it possible to do?
Well, it's very difficult to know the actual numbers because obviously governments don't come out and publish records in it. We believe that, for example, Burma has the largest number of political prisoners of conscience in prison, and there are thousands of them. So clearly the numbers of prisoners of conscience are very high, but at the same time, we need to attack the systems that create prisoners of conscience. So it's important to, of course, take up individual cases and work for their release, but it's also important to change the systems that imprison people for simply expressing their views.
Now, as I understand it, there was a big philosophical shift with Amnesty International just about the time that you came in. You were directed by your governing board to move from the straight support of prisoners of conscience as the number one core goal to this more systemic view, looking at economic justice, do I have that right? At broader systemic issues, not just the individual dissident in the prison, in the hole?
Well, what Amnesty International had realized over the years that it wasn't enough just working on individual cases. It was important for the individual, but you were helping to bring a person out of prison and then put someone else back into prison if you didn't address the system. And what we also realized that from the perspective of the individual, the survivor of human rights abuse, it's not just one particular right that's being attacked. For example, if you take a prisoner of conscience, when he is thrown into prison, it's not just his right to be free of arbitrary detention. It is also his right to family life, his right to work, his right to health sometimes in prison. These are also human rights. And so Amnesty International decided in 2001 that it would look holistically at human rights. It would look at the whole range of human rights, but from the perspective of the survivor of human rights abuse. And that actually led us in 2004 to take up the issue of violence against women. Now, if you look at women survivors of violence, sure, they don't get justice, but they don't get education. There's discrimination. There's apathy to their plight. All these things are also issues that need to be tackled. So from the perspective of the human being, all human rights matter.
In the Cold War, Amnesty International was a kind of something everybody could agree about, at least in the West. And lots of those letters went behind the Iron Curtain at that time or were directed there. With this new position, you're more like a political player. I mean, you're talking systemic politics. Has that helped your mission or has that hurt it? You're not exactly apolitical anymore, if you ever were. There was a Cold War dynamic, I guess you could say. But are you even less so now?
Well, I come from the humanitarian sector. I spent 21 years working for refugees. Now, I think human rights operate in a political context, whether they are civil and political rights. If you're asking a government to release a political prisoner, you're making a very what the government sees as a very political statement. So when it comes to the issue of right to health, why is it any less political or more political than asking a government to release a political prisoner? What's important is to recognize that all these rights are actually exist in international law, and they were developed in international law, not by Amnesty International, but by governments. Governments that came out of the Depression, like the United States in the 1930s. Now, it was President Roosevelt who talked about freedom from want alongside other freedoms. So there was a full recognition in the 40s of the importance of both economic and social rights and political and civil rights. What then happened was the Cold War. And in the Cold War, one group of governments, the Western governments, supported civil and political rights, and the socialist governments supported economic and social rights, creating a false boundary in human rights. Because for the human being, the right to education is as important as freedom of expression.
Of course, Roosevelt's policies are controversial in this country, and they're still a matter of political debate today, but doesn't mean that Amnesty International now comes down on one side of that argument.
No, Amnesty International comes down on both sides of the argument. We believe that civil and political rights and economic and social rights are both equally important if a human being is to achieve his or her full potential.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Irene Khan, Secretary General of Amnesty International, the world's largest human rights organization. She came in 2001, just after the 9/11 attack. She's headed out of this post at the end of this year. Her new book just out is The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights. We'll be joined in a moment by Nick Kristof of the New York Times. Irene Khan is with me in the studio. I wanted to ask you about, we've got a lot of particular issues here, but let's go first to the President of the United States, Barack Obama, recipient of the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize. Amnesty International won it in, 1977? One of your top people had won it even earlier than that, so you've got a couple of peace prizes. How do you look at the work of this young president? And we'll talk about Sudan in particular. New Sudan policy out today said to be a kind of modulation, softening of U.S. policy, I'm not sure, on Sudan. But first, just the prize itself and Barack Obama's work.
Well, Barack Obama has engaged with the world and has raised high expectations for change, turning the chapter on a dark decade on human rights. And so I think our expectations are more high than ever before with the Nobel Peace Prize, and we would expect President Obama to use the moral authority that the Peace Prize gives him, the additional moral authority of the Peace Prize, to be courageous on issues of accountability for past human rights crimes committed in the name of counterterrorism, but also courage and vision in tackling some of the toughest conflicts around the world. Sudan is one, in Darfur, and the Middle East is another.
He's declined recently to invite the Dalai Lama to the White House on his visit to the United States, first U.S. president to do that. What do you make of that? Is that a sign of capitulation on a human rights front? Or as Amnesty International chief, how do you look at that particular step?
I think the U.S. will have to play a very important role in bringing China into the fold of international human rights. And that's something that you don't do by giving in, but through persuasion. And I hope President Obama will persuade the Chinese government that if it's going to be a global power, it has to play by global rules and accept global values. And that, in my view, are the values of human rights.
What's the Amnesty International record tell you about what works there? Standing up and inviting the Dalai Lama, even if Beijing won't be happy? Or, you know, making nice by not having him, at least not yet. He says he'll meet him later.
Well, I think it takes both. It takes first dialogue with the Chinese, but it also takes the courage to stand up for what you believe in. If you believe that everyone has the right to freedom, to speak out their mind, then I think the U.S. Government should encourage people, invite them, and not be afraid of inviting people. At the same time, the U.S. government has to engage with the Chinese and make sure that they don't misunderstand this as a rejection of China, but as China coming into the fold of international values.
We're talking this hour with Irene Khan, Secretary General of Amnesty International, about the state of human rights in tough times right now. With us from New York now, Nicholas Kristof, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times. He writes the On the Ground blog for The Times, co-author with his wife Cheryl Wu Dunn of Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Nick Kristof, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Good to join you.
So We're talking with Irene Khan about the big picture, the big read, and sort of the sense that this decade has been a lost decade for human rights. How do you look at it, Nick?
Well, I mean, I think clearly that has been true in some respects. I do think that it has made a lot of people appreciate the importance of human rights more and the degree to which torture can become a slippery slope. So I hope we've learned from that decade and that in that respect it's not lost, but it has been a useful experience. I also think that in a number of countries around the world that there is, especially maybe in the developing world, that there is some appreciation that improved governance, which often does include some kind of greater respect for human rights, does indeed lead to greater economic development. And so, you know, there may have been some modest advancement there.
Look at the U.S. for a second. It's taken a lot of grief for Guantanamo, for Abu Ghraib, for the Iraq War itself and civilian deaths there. At the same time, it's been up against terror as a champion, the terror threat and more, as a champion of human rights. What's the American profile evolved toward in this decade, Nick Kristof?
Well, I mean, I think that we've ended up empowering our enemies with torture. You know, even if one thinks that there are some specific cases where we may have gained useful intelligence, which, you know, seems quite unclear, there's just no doubt that it's been one of the most effective recruiting tools for Al-Qaeda, for the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban, and for other radical groups. So I think that, you know, as an empirical matter, we're gaining useful understanding about the degree to which torture creates a backlash and ends up being counterproductive.
And now you and Amnesty International are both looking at women's rights in particular in this time. And, of course, a lot of people thinking about them as the United States considers what to do in Afghanistan, where the Taliban recently ruled. Why have you taken up women's rights in particular right now, Nick Kristof?
Well, I mean, I think two things. I think that traditionally, in the old days, we kind of misunderstood human rights as being just what governments did to dissidents. And, you know, I was in China, and, you know, the government did indeed some pretty terrible things to dissidents. But meanwhile, there were 30 million Chinese women who were missing. And globally, there are between 60 and 100 million, I mean, which is a human rights violation, a sort of lethal discrimination that far exceeds anything that governments do. And then just more broadly, I mean, I have a fascination with global poverty, and the evidence, again, is just accumulating that if you want to fight poverty effectively, if you want to fight fundamentalism, if you want to create more stable societies, then the most effective way to do that is to educate girls, empower women, bring them into the formal economy.
Irene Khan, you're the first woman to head Amnesty International, and during your tenure, this big push on women has come to the fore. Why now? Is it because of your gender, your particular background, or because of an evolving understanding about women's rights?
I think it is because of evolving understanding. My gender obviously helped because I made it a priority, but it is the issue of our times. As Nick is saying, if you don't tackle women's human rights, you're not going to get progress in development. One Afghan women activist said to me that a nation is like a bird with two wings. If one wing is broken, it can't fly. And I think increasingly governments around the world and people around the world are beginning to realize that you have to empower women and bring forward their progress onto the agenda much more prominently than ever before if you're going to really change the world.
Nick, we'll talk about human rights in the headlines. We'll go to Sudan, but first just on women's rights and Afghanistan. The Taliban ruled. Women were in very, very tough circumstances there. Of course, there's a long history of that in Afghanistan, but not always, not in every year. And now there's the issue of whether the United States, you know, stays in heavy or begins to pull out, maybe even cooperate with the Taliban coming in some degree back to power. How do you look at that as an issue of women's rights, Nick?
Well, I mean, it's clear that the rise of the Taliban has been very bad, in particular for women there. It's certainly been bad for men as well. But I don't think that the lesson of that is that we should send 40,000 more troops to Afghanistan. If one thinks about the Soviet period in Afghanistan, then when they sent a total of 620,000 troops through Afghanistan, they managed to create an oasis in Kabul that was fairly good for women, but ended up empowering the Mujahideen and the Taliban and creating a backlash that ultimately undermined the role of women. And I'm afraid that when we send more troops into Afghanistan, we do precisely create the sense of occupation, that a heavier military footprint tends to undermine security and, empower the more extremist elements in the Taliban. So I'm terrified of what happens as the Taliban gain strength, especially in the south, but I don't think the solution is a heavier military footprint for the Americans.
Irene Khan, you grew up in Muslim Bangladesh, gives you a particular, and in the region, gives you a particular view here. How do you see the NATO/US presence in Afghanistan? Are you hoping it stays strong, grows lighter, grows heavier?
Well, I would tend to agree with Nick that just focusing on militarization is not going to really solve the problems. You need to create a demand for progress. And governments tend generally either to take a security approach, put military in to fight the Taliban in Afghanistan, or to a lesser extent, building the institutions of the Afghan government, which is good. But the third element, which is actually building the demand side for good governance, is missing. And that means developing civil society, empowering women, bringing about social change from below, from the grassroots. That's a missing element in the Afghan agenda.
Hard to do when the bullets are flying. Does Amnesty take a position on these things? If you had President Obama's ear right now, would you say 40,000 more troops, Mr. President, or get out? Or do you have a position as Secretary General?
If I had President Obama's ear now, I would tell him, invest in the people of Afghanistan.
How do you do that when there's a war on?
Well,
the white trucks can't even leave Kabul, we're told.
Well, I think it is by empowering the people of Afghanistan. You've got to invest in people. You've got to invest in women. You've got to invest in health, education, employment for ordinary people so that they can rebuild their country. You can't import security from outside. You have to build it from within.
I want to hear from our listeners. Sarah calling from Saugus, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air with Irene Khan and Nicholas Kristof.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have always been very much interested in how the Amnesty International put a regulation towards the world as far as how we respect each other. However, my question is that I've lived in America for many years, and I was originally born and raised in Ghana, and mm-hmm. normally when they talk about human rights and poverty, they are more looking at Africa. But it is, I think, the crux of it, and I'm glad that you're mentioning China and Afghanistan. The crux of it is developing nation problem. We are not as organized as it is in the Western countries, and I think sometimes the expectations may be a little bit, you know, twisted in the sense that we don't have that high level establishment whereby you have most of the people were educated or the literacy rate very high. I think Kaza is facing a huge tribal division. It's not easy for him to really bring them together and let them vote in a manner that is expected as in Western countries.
So, Sarah, does that mean from your perspective you think that the developed nations should lay off the developing world when it comes to human rights, not complain about it so much or something else?
I mean, I think we have to use certain parameters. And at the same time, it has to be better understanding in the sense that I would take, say, demarcation of Africa. When you go back to history, the British and colonialists were sitting in London defining where Ghana should be, where Nigeria mm-hmm. should be, where other countries should be, without really being there to see the culture and the loyalties that people pay for the faith they have in their local governments, in their way of living. I think the whole establishment of living by nation state was something that was established by Western countries over developing nations whose cultural settings are very, very different.
Sarah, let us pick up your perspective in just a moment here. I'll go to Irene Khan with it. Nick Kristof, if I may, let me take that to you when it comes to Sudan first. The United States announcing a shift in policy today, more open to talk, but with sticks in here along with the carrots, we're told, just as an example. What do you make of Sarah's observation and the Sudan case and the policy shift today, Nick?
Well, I mean, there clearly are issues with sort of creating backlashes and a risk that, especially when we try to impose policies on Muslim countries, on Arab countries, and above all on Arab countries with oil, as in Sudan, that we're perceived as pursuing some kind of a colonialist or imperialist agenda.
But there's genocide sitting there, we're told.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think that's sort of a fact that we have to try to navigate around, and we have to build some political capital so that we can use it. I think that it's easier for President Obama to kind of pursue these policies than it was for President Bush. But at the end of the day, you look at your priorities, and I think ending genocide has to be a higher priority. My concern has been that the administration actually lost momentum after January, that Sudan was very alarmed about Susan Rice in particular, and about the administration, and that then this long Sudan review kind of gave the Sudan a break, and that it is no longer as nervous, and that in general we get Sudan to do things that we want, whether it's stop killing people or cooperate against terrorist financing, when it's scared about what we might do. I think it's really important to have those sticks in the hand, and I hope we indeed do have them.
Irene Khan, I want to come to you, but listen with us, if you would, to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in her news conference today, unveiling this new policy towards Sudan in particular. She said the strategy will be to talk with the government in Khartoum, but to hold them accountable during the process.
We are looking to achieve results through broad engagement and frank dialogue. But words alone are not enough. Assessment of progress and decisions regarding incentives and disincentives will be based on verifiable changes in conditions on the ground. Backsliding by any party will be met with credible pressure in the form of disincentives leveraged by our government and our international partners.
But the Obama administration is ready to talk with the government in Khartoum, maybe to a new degree. Irene Khan, head of Amnesty International, right decision here or not from a human rights perspective?
I think from the human rights perspective, dialogue and engagement is always a positive strategy. However, I think what's important here is coalition building. The U.S. can't go it alone on this issue. Otherwise, it will get the kind of backlash that others were just mentioning right now. It has to work with other countries in the region, with African countries, with Arab countries, to get them also to put pressure on Sudan. It's very important that those indicators that Hillary Clinton mentioned are evident soon, because people on the ground have been suffering from a war for almost a decade now. There, you have to have all the attacks and killings stop. You've got to get assistance to people on the ground. You've got to create some form of semblance of normal, if not normal life, some semblance of security for people on the ground. Those are not things to be achieved down the road. They have to be achieved now. And I hope that Obama administration's indicators will include the human rights situation of civilians right on top.
Nick Kristof, does it look then like, I don't know, like a real politic softening here, or realistic way toward a solution to this, you know, despite all the lawn signs, the Darfur situation hasn't really improved?
No, it hasn't. I mean, I think the Obama administration thinks of it as a more realistic approach, and I think they think one needs carrots as well as sticks. You know, my concern is just that, I mean, I think they're probably right that ultimately we're going to shape Sudanese policy with some combination of carrots and sticks, and we haven't really applied either. But I tend to think that the history of Sudan suggests that sticks are, a crucial part of that. And so far, we don't see those sticks. The real issue right now is less Darfur than it's the north-south piece in Sudan. And there is a very high risk that the north-south war in Sudan is going to begin again. In that case, the whole madness in Darfur is going to be remembered simply as a prologue to an even bloodier conflict. The last time the north-south war killed 2 million people, and you look at Sudan, and it looks like two freight trains heading down the track toward, crashing into each other, and that is the north-south conflict and the risk of that revival.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about human rights in a tough time, a tough world, with Irene Khan, Secretary General of Amnesty International, the first woman, the first Asian, the first Muslim to head the world's largest human rights organization, and with Nicholas Kristof, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the New York Times. He's out with a new book called Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Irene Khan is headed out of her post at Amnesty International with a book out as well, The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights, just out in the last couple of days. You can read excerpts of each at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's get a call right here from Nashville, Tennessee. John. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would have to say looking at the way the situations have been over the last 5 to 6 years, maybe even 8 to 10, that human rights around the world, it appears, has gone down only because they've been possibly ignored in certain areas, focusing only on other regions. But I think that it all stems from the same thing, and I understand what your guests are trying to say, is that it's a generational thing. It always has been. For each thing that happens in another country, it's an individual that takes on that burden, and they pass it on. And those things, without a long period of time of support, will never be solved. And Afghanistan is a perfect example of that. And I think that a lot of times people look at things in a snapshot, but they don't look at the overall situation. I think Amnesty has a responsibility, though, to take that and try to change it into success for some stability. But without that long-term stability, I just don't see things changing. And
do you think they're right to go after systemic issues, John, beyond simply working for the release of particular prisoners of conscience?
I think it's necessary to go after systemic in conjunction with creating a stable environment, because that's part of the plan. You can't be a long-term success in any country without having systemic issues on the forefront.
I'll put that to the Secretary General, and thanks for calling, John. But Nick Christoph, let me put it to you first. Here's one organization, a very big one, with a long and proud track record on human rights. They were very good at raising particular prisoners of conscience to public attention and sometimes release. How do you see it when a group like Amnesty International goes at these broader systemic issues? Is that obvious and necessary that they should? Does it you know, spread their fire and maybe diminish their impact? How do you look at it, Nick?
I really don't know. I mean, I think that it's important to tackle the broader systemic issues. I do think that it's often easier to engage people and make a connection on an individual case. But I do, it's sort of regarding John's point about the systemic issues, I think that there's kind of been an interesting natural experiment in how one approaches these issues between Pakistan and Bangladesh, Irene's native country, that since 9/11, we spent $11 billion in Pakistan supporting the government largely to build up its military capacity. And that has done nothing for the Pakistani people, nothing for stability there, and nothing for American soft power there, nothing for the American image.
Mm-hmm.
And in contrast, in Bangladesh, when it split off from Pakistan in 1971, and Irene, please correct me if you disagree with this analysis, but you know, it seems to me that originally Bangladesh was really appeared essentially hopeless, and the one thing that it really did that was quite different from Pakistan was that it educated girls. And today in Bangladesh, there are in fact more girls in high school than there are boys, and all those educated girls then helped create the basis for the garment industry, which brought a little more economic stability, earned hard currency for Bangladesh, laid the groundwork for all the women going into the social sector, groups like Grameen and BRAC, which built up a virtuous cycle of stability, undermined fundamentalism, undermined extremism. And so, you know, there are other factors as well, but I think it's one major reason why Bangladesh is not a country that the Pentagon is worried about, while Pakistan is.
Irene Khan, this is your bailiwick. You grew up in the teeth of that civil war in Bangladesh. So is this an example of what you're talking about, how addressing issues of justice, of human rights, may be more important than any other single factor?
Well, in Bangladesh, I would say the stability that it enjoys today is largely because, as Nick said, the development of civil society, and particularly women's groups. Women did get opportunities, education, but also employment. Microcredit opened up possibilities for them to get assets, to set up entrepreneurial businesses. All that actually has been a huge damper on the development of Islamic fundamentalism. I'm not saying that there aren't fundamentalist groups in Bangladesh. There are, and they remain as a threat. There is a risk there. But that risk is being checked by the action that women are taking throughout the country, ordinary women, village women, getting together.
Let's go to Paul in Lincoln, Nebraska. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was intrigued by the comments about this systemic attack, the causes of abuses of human rights made earlier and what Amnesty's doing there. I guess my question, though, is how does Irene Khan, as a Muslim woman, reconcile the belief system that she follows with the human rights issue regarding women? And then the second follow-on question is to that, isn't the right to choose what one believes the most fundamental of human rights?
Irene Khan.
Well, let me start by saying that Islam as a religion is practiced from Morocco to Indonesia, and it varies. Interpretations of Islam vary enormously, and to my mind, the most conservative, the most retrogressive versions of Islam are actually being pushed in some political systems. And I see this not as an issue of whether Islam respects women's rights or not, but very often it's a power play. I have met many Muslim governments and they have complained to me about how human rights standards violate their own views of Islamic standards for women. But, you know, the Islamic law also forbids the taking of interest. There are financial restrictions.
Usury.
And I don't hear in Muslim governments, Islamic governments, coming to me and saying they cannot participate in the international financial system because of Sharia law. So what does that mean? Why does Sharia law come forward when it's the issue of women's rights and Sharia law is not put forward when it comes to international financial systems? To me, this is a question of power, not of religion
or
culture.
But Paul's representing a perspective that is not uncommon, I think, in the United States these days, that Islam somehow itself, as practiced in the arc that you describe, represents a kind of threat to human rights. I realized many Muslims will say that's completely backwards. Nevertheless, that's a common perception.
It is a perception, but I would challenge that perception because I don't think it's religion. I think it's the use that people make of religion, and very often political leaders, the use that they make of religion that promotes a particular perspective over another. Islam has also encouraged progress on women's development. Islam is all in favor
Where?
Of girls' education. Girls' education is promoted very highly in
Where?
Islam.
Where?
In the Quran.
No, I mean in the world.
Yes. Well, in the world, you just heard Nick talk about Bangladesh, which is a majority mm-hmm. Muslim country, mm-hmm. about 90%
mm-hmm.
Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And girls' education is not hindered there. If you look at Malaysia, look at Indonesia, look at
mm-hmm.
Southeast Asia,
mm-hmm.
girls' education is very highly promoted in many of those countries.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, you know, on the other hand, you see Saudi Arabia, where actually, interestingly enough, education of girls is very high. Majority of students at the universities in Saudi Arabia today are women. But when it comes to employment, women are a very small minority. So these are, what I'm saying is, these are state policies that are being promoted for reasons other than religion that hold women back in Muslim countries.
Thank you. Let's go to Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts. Jackie, you're on the air.
Thank you. I've been so concerned for many years now about the conditions in Iraq. I don't know why there's not more coverage and more discussion of the terrible conditions there, since we really destroyed the country since our invasion in 2003. And now, according to our libraries, more than 1 million people have died there. Yet I don't hear anything about that. And I'm surprised. I know that we're very much concentrating on Afghanistan, but in Afghanistan now, we've killed 7,000 people because of 3,000 we lost horribly on 9/11. And I don't understand why there's no kind of accountability to us. Why isn't there some kind of discussion of what kind of policies are we having to cause such trouble in a country that had not harmed us at all, Iraq?
Jackie, let us pick it up. Nick Kristof, go to the issue of, from Jackie's observation of war and terror and human rights. I mean, I look back now on what I sort of think of as the heyday of Amnesty International. Irene Khan may disagree, but when it was really coming out and blossoming, people were picking it up very enthusiastic. These were Cold War years, and people felt so good about trying to get prisoners out, you know, out of prison somewhere far off. Now there's terror right in New York, and there's war with the United States in the middle of it, and there are human rights abuses in the middle of those invasions and military actions. What happens to human rights in this more complicated picture, Nick?
Well, I think it becomes so important that we do police ourselves better, because obviously in this kind of a environment, then there becomes a huge temptation to go down that slippery slope and to beat up somebody who we're holding, or to allow that person to be beaten up to. And in fact, I mean, I think the evidence is pretty clear that when one does that really has helped our enemies, and especially been a powerful recruiting tool. It may be that was less the case say, 50 years ago in Algeria, although it probably was to some degree, but now communications are so good that it really, I think, becomes, you know, hugely counterproductive and makes it all the more. Well, I think it's clear that, you know, General McChrystal, for example, is incredibly concerned about airstrikes, because in Afghanistan, one of the things that has hurt us the most has been all these wedding parties that we've ended up inadvertently bombing. And every wedding party that gets bombed, creates more Taliban than 10 successful strikes on the Taliban.
How do you look at war and human rights, Irene Khan? I mean, there are the deaths on the ground. There are the deaths from the air. Even drone attacks, they're seen as the surgical thing, but they very, very often, as Pakistanis well know, kill plenty of civilians around them. How do you reconcile?
Unfortunately, modern warfare is fought in a way in which civilians suffer more than the military. Military are protected and civilians suffer. And that's why one line that Amnesty International pushes very hard is independent investigation into these incidents, so that we can find out what went wrong and so that they're not repeated again. The other point I would like to make here is that the emphasis in counterterrorism strategies is on national security. And what it needs to do is it has to shift to focus on human security, because unless you start addressing the communities from which terrorists may be drawing support and meet their grievances and bring them onto your side, then I'm afraid this is a losing war that's being fought.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Nick Kristof, let's go to another arena there. The conflict in Gaza late last year, early this year, and then the UN panel headed by Goldstone that came out saying war crimes, Israeli war crimes, Hamas war crimes. I mean, here we are again, war and human rights not sitting well on the same page.
Right. I mean, I think one of the larger problems in the United States is that we often are quite naive about how our actions are perceived around the world. And, you know, sometimes that's frankly because people are unfair to the big guy on the block, and there is a particular sense that whoever is big and powerful is behind various conspiracy theories or is trying to steal oil in places. So, I mean, some of those perceptions are unfair, but in any case, those are real. And I think that Americans too often think that our actions will be seen in a benign light and don't appreciate this prism of colonialism, of suspicion, that our actions are perceived. And I think that's one of the reasons for a lot of missteps. I also think that actually that bears on human rights issues, that in Half the Sky, one of the issues we look at is female genital cutting, female circumcision. And that's an area, frankly, where there's been a real international effort for more than 30 years that has been astonishingly unsuccessful, partly because it has created a backlash, and that when Americans say, don't cut your daughters, that, you know, we have no credibility. And in the meantime, I think that if we had done more to work to support local grassroots initiatives by local women within these communities to end female genital mutilation, that would have been far more successful. I think we can kind of learn from that approach.
Nick, look at it another way. China is becoming bigger and bigger on the world stage now. What about, you have a lot of experience with China, what about the net impact of that on human rights? We just saw the killings of protesters in Guinea and rapes in the public stadium there, and now reports that China may be investing $7 billion in minerals there. The U.S. was the big dog, now China is getting pretty big. Net impact on human rights, how do you see it?
Well, China obviously plays a very unhelpful role in countries like Guinea, in supporting Sudan, in supporting Zimbabwe. On the other hand, China has a pretty powerful foreign aid program in Africa and educates vast numbers of Africans back in China, which certainly overall tends to have a more positive effect. So, you know, it cuts both ways, I think, in a way that we in America often don't appreciate. But there's no doubt that China is being regarded with a lot more suspicion within Africa as it becomes more powerful.
Irene Khan, the end of this year, you're headed out of a position that you've held as Secretary General of Amnesty International during quite a difficult time. What gives you hope for human rights as you look ahead, and what are your biggest concerns?
Well, my biggest concern is, as Nick has very rightly pointed out in his book, the rise of the non-state actor in the human rights sector, private actors, whether they are companies, whether they are individuals, whether they are community leaders.
Their is it a good impact, thing or a bad thing?
Well, if they are not regulated, if I can put regulation in quotes, if they're not brought within the human rights system and held accountable, then there is room for abuse of power. And that's what Nick so powerfully puts in his book, and that's what I talk about in my book, too. That's the challenge.
On the hope front?
On the hope front, I think it's people. Today, if human rights have gained anywhere, it has gained in the hearts and minds of people. In my country, around the world, in Africa, in Latin America, ordinary people are speaking about human rights. They may not always use the human rights language, but they speak about justice, they speak about fairness, they speak about equality, they speak about women's situation. Those, to me, are human rights issues that are gaining strength because human rights has gone global by going local.
A global sense of what should be. Irene Khan, outgoing Secretary General of Amnesty International, author of The Unheard Truth, thank you very much for being with us this hour. It's great to have you. Good luck to you. And Nick Kristoff, The New York Times, author of Half the Sky. Nick, it's always wonderful to have you. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.